At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson. We live in a digital age where we spend a whole lot of time on our personal devices and specifically interacting with social media. But have you considered how the digital world shapes you? Particularly, how does it shape your soul? To help us think through these questions is Samuel James. Samuel is the Associate Acquisitions Editor at Crossway Books. He's a graduate of Boyce College in Louisville, where he lives with his wife Emily and their three children. He's also the author of a new book called Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. Samuel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Richard. It's so good to be with you.
It's really good to see you, really good to have you with us, and I need to clear this out at the beginning of the program, that you actually did some writing for the Commonwealth Policy Center when we were first beginning, and probably my biggest mistake I've ever made here at CPC was not hiring you to work full-time for us. But man, it is really good to be back with you and to talk about this important topic. And I think when we first met, it was probably 2012, 2014, somewhere in that range. I think that's about when you were doing some of the writing for us. This whole arena of digital technology has seen significant changes just in the last 10 years, 11 years. But I want to start out with your book, though, and I'm going to go to the beginning where you share a story of how you were impacted by Facebook immediately after graduating from high school. You opened up a Facebook account with the intention to connect and stay in touch with some of your peers who went on to college out of state. But you had a poignant statement there. You said, somehow an entire adolescence worth of insecurity, crushes, ambition, and identity became compressed and contained inside a small, red, pixelated square at the upper hand, right-hand corner of our family PC. And then you go on to say that so many people center their lives on social media. And it's clear it's to a point where social media now controls us. We spend so much time and energy and attention on it that we view ourselves through social media, and we view reality through social media as well. And you flesh this out in your book. But when did you begin to realize and observe these things, that social media began shaping us?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So looking back from where I am now, I think I can detect that I started to notice that I was becoming a slightly different person, and then eventually a significantly different person, for the way that this technology had really kind of redefined my relationship with other people, with my own beliefs. I realized I was kind of deciding what I thought about really big topics based on who was saying what. And so there was almost kind of a sense of letting social media think for me. And I could kind of sense the instability and the, you know, proclivity to quickly change my views on big topics that tends to bring. I think the deciding moment, though, was around the 2016 election, when it just pretty much became obvious to me that between the 2016 election and the conversation around Donald Trump, but then also moving on to conversations around what was happening in Ferguson and things like that, it became obvious to me that me and many other people I knew were talking about life, were talking about being a Christian, were talking about politics much differently online than we tended to talk about them in real person, in embodied presence. So when I would get together with people and talk about these big topics, there was kind of a a patience, a you know, a desire to kind of hear the other person out. Even if we didn't agree, we would kind of try to articulate what the other person believed in a fair way. And what I saw was that on social media, the people that really did successful and the people who were really good at getting a platform were the people who did the opposite of this. And so it was this incentive structure to get more people to click your stuff if you were more bombastic, kind of more black and white, less careful in your thinking and less Christian in the way you talk to other people. And I noticed those same impulses in myself. So it was kind of around that time that I started to think, okay, like which part of this is the real me? Is it the offline me or is it the online me? And through the reading that I did, I came to the conclusion that the answer was yes, both sides were real, but it was that that there was a different habitats that brought both of these elements of who I was to the forefront.
That's very good. And I'm glad that you began noticing this and thinking through this issue and how it was changing you as well. You say in your book, I'm going to move ahead here, there's an objectiveness to reality to which we as human creatures must conform if we are to live whole and well. The Bible calls a response to this objective reality wisdom. Wisdom is real, wisdom is embodied, and it is wisdom that is obscured in the digital world. Samuel, the obvious question here is, how is wisdom obscured? And before you answer that, you know, we often hear that, boy, this technology is great. It helps us to connect. We have more information. We can have these dialogues that we wouldn't normally have with other mediums that we had previously. So those are some of the arguments to maintain a digital presence and to use digital technology. But you're saying that wisdom is obscured. I guess I'll need to drill in. Are you talking about digital world in general, or specifically, are you talking about social media where wisdom is obscured?
That's a really good question. In the context of the book, I'm thinking more broadly than social media, but I'm thinking especially of social media in terms of how we experience this this obscuring of wisdom. So I think there's something true of the entire internet, of this entire technology that tends to hide reality. It tends to kind of make us, I kind of use this illustration, like because I am online, whoever I choose to be and whatever I choose to share about myself, there's a sense in which I'm exercising something godlike online, because we can only know God by the way he reveals himself. So when I can kind of control what people know about me and my sense of identity by what I share online, there's a sense in which I'm playing God. And I think that's true of the entire concept of the web, as Nicholas Carr talks about in his book, The Shallows. But I think for most people, this effect is going to be the most important in social media. Social media has become the most direct way that I would say probably a majority of people in the world today interact with this effect of what the web does to us. And I think there are other effects too, but particularly the way that social media disembodies us. So what that means is basically it takes us away from the physical world and it puts our attention, our emotions, our theology even into an abstracted electronic environment where we're not encountering physical bodies, we're not encountering real spaces. So something called context collapse has been coined to refer to the fact that, you know, on the internet, you could be talking to everybody or nobody. When you say such and such is the biggest problem facing the church today, you don't have to specify which church you're talking about. You don't have to specify what kind of problem you're talking about. It's context collapse. You just talk in this very generic way. What the Bible tells us is that the essence of wisdom is to live along the grain of reality. So God has made his world a certain way, and the way to live wisely is to live in accordance with the way he designed it. That means living in light of who he is and living in light of who you are and living in light of what the world is really like. And to the extent that social media presents us with the emotions of relationship, the sensation of thought, but it's completely abstracted from the embodied world, the physical world, and the things that attend that, it's kind of counterfeit wisdom. It will always kind of obscure, like a foggy mirror, what we're seeing. What we'll never kind of see reality for what it is, because we're not actually giving our attention and our emotional energy to reality. We're giving it to this habitat that is denying a fundamental part of what it means to be made in the image of God.
That's really good, Samuel. I want to push back a little bit, if I could. You were arguing that there's a tendency where we can make ourselves godlike. We project a certain image. We can create a certain image and project this to the larger culture. How does that differ from somebody who was a writer and projecting a certain image, sharing a certain view? How does the habitat, the digital habitat, lend itself for us becoming maybe more godlike than just a writer projecting a certain image?
So what I would say there is that there are multiple ways in which we can kind of present this false version of ourselves, or kind of obscure who we really are. And that's a problem as old as Adam and Eve trying to hide in the garden after they sin, and the Lord says, "Where are you?" You know, they're trying to hide from God. They're trying to hide from ultimate reality. That's a problem as old as Eden. The aspect with social media, though, is particularly potent because of how much attention it consumes. So, you know, a writer who is maybe writing books or articles and is projecting this persona in their writing, which has absolutely happened. You know, there's been plenty of people who've pretended to be somebody that they're not. You know, famous case with the New Republic and Stephen Glass, that reporter who got fired for making up stories. The difference there, though, is that social media kind of presents a mediation of almost every aspect of your life, like your friendships, even your romantic relationships, even your encounter with church. Like a modern person can date, can hang out, and can go to school and worship completely online if they so choose. It's not implausible to do all those things digitally. And so what you're seeing is the meaning of what it means to be a person kind of devolve down into, well, if you have a name and a profile picture, you're a person. And I think that's quite a bit different than most of the technologies that we have seen up to this point. It's not that this problem is utterly novel, because it's not. There's nothing new under the sun. But it is that it is capitalizing our attention and our emotional energy just because we carry it around so much. I actually think there's a pronounced difference even between pre-2008 and post-2008. So the internet obviously is a major force in the 90s, but what happens in 2008 is that Steve Jobs brings out the iPhone, and the iPhone becomes a way for the internet to become what I call ambient. So it's no longer a tool that has to be plugged into a particular spot in your house where you have to always be near Wi-Fi. The internet becomes something you literally cannot choose to escape without a great exertion of will. It's carrying with that that dehumanizing of the technology literally in your pocket and everywhere you go. So it's really the omnipresence of this technology and the way that almost every part of our life is affected somehow by simply not having to be a fully embodied human when we do the most fundamental human things like worship or learn or talk to one another.
Samuel, you say in your book, in the online age, our default is to lose touch with reality. Left to ourselves and our machines, we find that wisdom often looks foolish, virtue often looks evil, and God often feels invisible. Every person living in a modern, digitally connected culture is constantly inhabiting a moral and intellectual habitat that distorts the biblical story of reality. Now, there's a lot there, and this adds to what you were saying. But the idea that wisdom can look foolish, let's just focus on that a little bit. You already touched on it, but for Christians, we know what it means to. We know what God expects of us. We understand the fruits of the Spirit. We understand how we're to relate to our fellow man. And yet, in this digital habitat, Those who are popular and have the most likes and those videos that go viral are the ones that are contrary to biblical principles. So let's talk about Christians in particular regarding that. Have Christians spoken out on this? Have they engaged that? Have they called this out before? Or are you the lone voice in the wilderness, man, pointing this out? Tell me that there's others that are doing this.
Oh, there absolutely are. If you're truly the lone voice, then usually that's a sign that you're wrong. God has a way of working through his church and working through his body where, you know, if the Lord's revealing something to one person that's true, it's from his word, and there are other people who are catching on to the same thing. So yeah, this has absolutely been talked about, and it's being talked about more, which is really encouraging. There are some friends I have, like Chris Martin works in the for Lifeway Publishing and does a lot of work on this topic and has been helpful for me. And Andy Crouch as well has had a long ministry of kind of talking about culture in this way. So there are many voices talking about this. I do think, though, that for particularly the evangelical church in America, I think there has been a tendency when it comes to media technology and the internet in particular, we've been single-mindedly focused on the content. So when you talk about the internet, we are mostly concerned about what you should and should not seek out on the internet. So purity and, you know, accountability and filters and things like that. That has kind of dominated the evangelical conversation about the web. And there's certainly a place for that. That's definitely important. But there hasn't been as much conversation about the form of the web itself. Is there something to this technology that is actually undermining at a very granular level what it means to think and feel like a Christian? And so I think there has been a renewed interest in that question in the last few years, partially because the people who came of age like I did in the kind of initial ascendance of the internet and then in the smartphone era, we're becoming parents. We're old enough to parent children. And so we're thinking about these technologies, not just from a pure novelty perspective, but also from a, okay, what do you want your children to do? And there's the famous story that came out a couple of years ago about how Silicon Valley executives keep these technologies away from their own kids. Like there's literally, you know, Apple and Google employees who won't let their kids have iPads and tablets and things like that. So I think the ability to imagine what it would be like for your child to be immersed in this technology is kind of what's creating the renewed interest. But I still think there's a lot of exploration to be done. And for the average evangelical, it still mostly is a question of, well, as long as I only look at good things online, I'll be fine. Not so much a critical approach to whether this technology might actually have something intrinsic to it that I need to be aware of.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Samuel James, and we are talking about how digital mediums, particularly social media, influences us. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that the news media isn't always fair. In fact, there's lots of far-left bias and political gamesmanship. No surprise there. So if you're looking for a perspective that's grounded in the truth of Scripture and our nation's founding principles, then get plugged into CPC's resources. Sign up for our e-newsletter at CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Commonwealth Policy Center. And we're on Twitter at CPC4Kentucky.
Samuel, just before the break, you had talked about evangelical Christians being concerned about content, what is on the internet, and guarding themselves against negative content. In particular, you make the case in your forthcoming book that the internet does not just contain pornography, but that it is pornographically shaped. You went on to explain that the web's nature as a novelty machine, however, is intrinsic to its nature as a pornographic medium. There's a vital connection between aimless immersion in content and the spiritual mood that primes a heart to seek out lust. I'm going to skip down here, and then you say, emotionally numbed by endless scrolling, the human heart tends to become inclined towards that which simply offers a dash of color to an otherwise drab listlessness. In other words, the mindless search for more stuff pushes us toward the temporary thrill and pseudo-connection of online porn. You go on to explain that in greater detail, but that whole idea that the internet is pornographically shaped, that was provocative, made me think a little bit, and that might catch some of our listeners off guard. But I'd like you to speak to this idea that this medium of the internet is pornographically shaped.
So when we think about like what pornography is, essentially it is trying to consume that which cannot be consumed. You're trying to kind of take this most intimate and most personal, most humane experience, and you're trying to package it up as a spectator sport, like something that you can just kind of consume for a minute and then be done with and move on. When we think about pornography that way, it pretty much becomes clear that there's a lot of things that in our normal life that kind of follow that same logic. So, whether it is using an app like Instagram and kind of looking at people's vacation photos or their family pictures, and what do we see? We see beautiful families that kind of make us think that ours must be dysfunctional in some way. We see, gorgeous homes that are not like ours. And it kind of arouses this discontentment within us. It was like, well, what's actually going on is that the people taking those photos are working hours to stage those photos so that they look that way. That's exactly what the logic of pornography is. It's I'm going to stage this thing so that you can kind of consume it and it can be this false version of a meaningful experience. And I use the example in the book. There's a genre of YouTube video that's really fascinating. It's called the reaction video. And if there's hundreds of thousands of these on YouTube, and most of them are PG at best, that they're not problematic. But what you're simply watching is a person like on a screen, like me, you're watching me watch something else. Like, and if it's something funny, you'll watch me laugh. If it's something shocking, you'll watch me kind of grimace. If it's something serious, you might watch me tear up. And this is a massive genre on YouTube. What is that? Well, that is the experience of friendship. That's the experience of friendship being turned into a consumable product. Because what do you do when you're with friends watching a movie? You not only watch the movie, you watch other people watch the movie, right? It's a social experience, and that adds to your enjoyment. So what the reaction video is, essentially, is it's an artifact of a digital culture in which most of us, many of us, probably most of us, are so alone and so friendless that the most likely option for how we would spend a few minutes out of a day is to watch someone on a screen, watch something else. And so we kind of feel like we're having that social experience with them, but of course we're not, we don't even know them. We're not with them. So that's kind of what I mean by the packaging up of human experience as kind of this consumable product that I can click, get like a simulated experience of, and then move on to the next thing very quickly. And I think people underestimate the degree to which the amount of that kind of stuff online can actually turn us into the kind of people who prefer that instead of going out with friends and seeing the new movie. There's a part of us that wants to avoid the awkwardness of in-person relationship. And instead, I'll just watch this video again, kind of helping me to feel like I'm part of a community when I'm not.
You mentioned on your Twitter feed, I want to move ahead to another topic. You mentioned that your Twitter feed has been filled with unusually grotesque images of videos captured at various LGBTQ events with the purpose of bringing attention of some kind of evil or another. Now, this was from people who I think would identify as conservatives, and they would say their intent is to raise about awareness. Hey, have you seen this? Or are you aware of that? And you have a response to that in your digital liturgies, but you can find it on Substack. just subscribe to it. And by the way, it was well worth, I think it's $40 a year. I was getting your free version, and I'm like, I need to read more about what Samuel's saying on these things because it's so good. Just recently subscribed, but you mentioned this in one of your Substack columns about conservatives in particular sharing some outrage that's going on in some corner of the world. And you had a warning about this. Speak to that if you would. And just, we've got a couple minutes here.
Yeah, I think the warning there is that the nature of the internet, and I talk about this in the book, is that it can't help but create kind of this positive mystique toward what we see on it. You know, so there's an old film critic who once said that he, in his belief, a true anti-war film was impossible because the medium of film beautifies war. And regardless of whether or not you think he was right about that, I think something similar is probably true of the web. It's that when we encounter something that is genuinely shocking, when we fixate our attention on it, when we try to make it go viral, there is something that breaks in our kind of gag reflex toward it. There's something that kind of almost just through morbid fascination can kind of form an empathy with it. And I think it's extremely important for conservatives to realize that these are soul-shaping things that we're watching. That's why they're so outrageous. It's because people are genuinely shaped by this thing and have been consuming stuff like this for years. And so it's made them into the kinds of people that don't feel any shame or guilt over doing these kinds of things. But we could actually be more influenced by that than we think simply by fixating our attention on it. And I don't think the way to raise awareness on this is to make it go viral in people's feeds. I think you can tell people that things like this are going on without kind of arousing the sense of curiosity and fascination that really tends to beautify everything that we find online, no matter how much revulsion we're supposed to feel toward it, because it's presented in this glossy digital package, it tends to elicit different emotions eventually. So I think we should be very cautious about that.
Very good. Great last word. Samuel James, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. I look forward to your new book coming out, Digital Liturgies. Strongly recommend it. From what I've seen, it's an excellent book.